Wild Missions original podcast.
Wildfires have always been a natural hazard ingrained in the history of forests across Washington State in the US Pacific Northwest. But in recent years, their impact has grown more severe, with longer lasting and more intense blazes, pushing this region's fragile ecosystems right to the very brink. Amongst the wildlife that call these forests home is the subpopulation of the Canada lynx, a medium-sized species of lynx that ranges across Alaska, Canada, and some northern areas of the US. With each devastating wildfire, the Canada lynx's future here grows more uncertain, their once familiar territory now fragmented, altered, and their survival now in a race against time. I'm Andy Varvel, and this is Cats of the Wild, episode 34, Feline Fire Survivors.
Always known that I wanted to do wildlife research. I grew up in Western Washington, out in the countryside.
Meet Carmen Van Bianchi. She's the co-founder and research director for Home Range Wildlife Research.
My dad was a botanist, my mom an artist. Both of them really, you know, just took us camping as kids and backpacking. And so just grew up in the outdoors and grew up with animals, learning science. I did a kindergarten science fair project. The question was, do frogs croak when they hear other frogs croaking? And so I had a trium of Pacific chorus frogs, and they got loose in the gym the night before the science fair. But I guess the point of that story is that I've been doing science since I was a little kid and always been really passionate about it. So it was a natural growth into doing wildlife biology for me.
Like many wildlife biologists in the US, Carmen has immersed herself in numerous projects across the country, often working on a seasonal basis. Her primary research focus centered around mammals, with a particular focus on carnivores. This hands-on experience equipped her with valuable skills in field data collection and a keen sense of what constitutes sound scientific study design.
Washington has always been home for me. And so about 15 years ago, I came back to Washington and settled in the Metau Valley and worked on various projects there and started to really settle into a landscape and an environment and a suite of ecosystems that over the years, I'm starting to know them very intimately. Of course, that, you know, getting to know a landscape never stops, but I'm invested in this North Cascades environment and this landscape. And I care a lot about it. I've seen a lot of change over the years. And so settling into the North Cascades and putting down roots and then starting Home Range feels like where I can best contribute because I have invested in this landscape and I think I know it fairly well. Not to say that I will never stop learning it, but I feel like I can contribute to it because I've been watching it for a while now.
Let's consult the world map for a moment. So Washington State, not to be confused with Washington, D.C., is located in the northwestern region of the contiguous United States. It shares its northern border with Canada, with Vancouver less than an hour away. The state is flanked by the Pacific Ocean to the west, Idaho to the east, and Oregon to the south. Situated in the northeastern part of Washington State, the Meadow Valley rests in the foothills of the North Cascade mountain range.
It's really a unique place because it's sort of the confluence or coming together of a lot of southern ecotypes with some northern ecotypes stretching down from BC. So it's this place where you can wake up and have your coffee in sagebrush steppe. And then, you know, by the time 9 or 10 rolls around, you're up in the boreal forest or sub-boreal forest of the higher elevation mountains. And so we've got, you know, more southern species like the pygmy rabbits. And then we've got, for example, the Canada lynx way up in the boreal, making a living on the southern edge of their range. The core of Canada lynx ranges in Canada and Alaska, and their range stretches down into the contiguous U.S. in just five places that are occupied by lynx. And so they're making a living where there are fingers of the sub-boreal forest type that comes down into the lower 48 and where those deep snowy winters occur. And the reason they do so well in those deep snowy areas is because of their physical adaptations. They weigh about the same as a bobcat. Their average weight overlaps with that of a bobcat, but they look a lot bigger. And that's because they have really fluffy fur, obviously to stay warm, and they've got long legs, but they're quite lightweight. They're about, on average 20 to 22, maybe 25 pounds. So they've got these long legs, and then they've got these ridiculous, huge Muppet paws. And so what happens there is they've got the right amount of foot loading. So that's the ratio of foot size to their body weight that they can float essentially on top of the snow. Whereas somebody like a bobcat, they've got really tiny feet, especially, you know, to compare to their body size. And so they're punching right through. So what that means is that in winter, Canada lynx can easily get around and hunt for their primary prey, which is snowshoe hares. Whereas a bobcat would have a really hard time getting around in that same deep snow environment. So they've really carved out a niche for themselves because of those physical adaptations. And once you've seen a couple of them or seen pictures of them, they do have a pretty unique look, mostly because of those big feet. And you can tell apart from bobcats that way.
In Washington State, the Canada lynx are living at the periphery of their range. They're right at the edge. Their numbers are naturally lower. Life is harder. And on top of that, there's habitat degradation and a pretty intense history of fur trapping.
In 2000, lynx in the lower 48 were federally listed as threatened. In Washington, in the past 20 years, so since that listing, we've had a bit of a unique situation. We have had a switch in our wildfire regime. And that means that in just the past 20 years, a lot, if not most of their habitat has burned in huge megafires. And so all that is to say that their landscape is changing very quickly, and we don't have an actual count or great population estimate, but mostly based on what we know so far about what fired us to their habitat and how much habitat we think there is. Estimates come in for our North Cascades population as being around 50. So not that many animals. And then to reflect this, in 2016, they were state listed as endangered. And that was in large part to the fact that we've had these massive wildfires just completely transforming their landscape.
To really understand the threat of these megafires to the Canada lynx and why all of a sudden these fires are bigger, longer, and more intense, we have to look back at the history of fires, fire management, and climate change in the North Cascades.
It can be sort of categorized into three basic eras. What we call the historic fire era, the fire suppression era, and what we're in now, which is the megafire era. So the historic fire regime, we're learning a lot about from some really great work coming out of the wildfire ecology field. And what we're finding is that specifically in the North Cascades, in our lynx habitat, so that sub-boreal forest type, and when I say that, I mean sort of high elevation or northern cold forests that are growing mostly lodgepole, spruce, or fir trees. So the historical fire regime of that environment in Washington was a really lively fire regime. And by that, I mean little fires were burning quite often. I think of it as kind of a pitter-patter of fires were happening, just dotting the landscape all over. And so while one individual forest stand might not burn very often, somewhere on the landscape was burning. And every so often, there'd be climatic events where it'd be, you know, extra hot and dry, basically, and there would be a huge, big, sweeping wildfire. But the thing to understand here is that pitter-patter of fires, that dotting of the landscape, did some really key things. One, it created this mosaic of different habitat types, right? Because we had fires happening all the time. We had patches that were just freshly, you know, burned. And so they were very open. Not a lot of vegetation there yet. Areas that burned and were actually open, they just burned often enough that they were just open meadow. Trees weren't allowed to encroach those meadows. You had, you know, later stages of regeneration where you had medium-sized trees growing in really thick. And then you had places that hadn't burned in a long time and had, you know, older mature forests. So from a fire perspective, what that did was two things. And the most important was it created this negative feedback loop, which is what Paul Hesburgh, who's a wildfire ecologist here in Washington, calls it, wherein the many frequent little fires sort of created natural fire breaks or just basically fire speed bumps out there on the landscape. And so the fires that would burn, you know, this year meant that in subsequent years, that patch could act as a little speed bump for fires. So fires were slowing the spread, the size, and the severity of future fires. It was natural fuels management. The other thing that those fires did is that when a big fire did come, it was burning over a very varied palette, and that created what we call pyrodiversity. That big fire burned in a really diverse way. There were areas where it you know, burned really hot and severe and just torched the trees. There were areas where it mellowed down and was more of a just an understory burn and the overstory trees remained alive. There were patches that it completely skipped and didn't burn at all. And so it meant that those burns burned in a very heterogeneous way, and they themselves left behind a mosaic burn scar. And so you've got this richness, this texture across the landscape between all these little burns and even within these larger burns. Then we move into the suppression era. About 150, 100 years ago, we started putting out fires to try and save viable timber. And in the 1940s here in Washington in the North Cascades, we got really good at that. And so we're putting out hundreds of natural fire starts that may have otherwise been these little burns. And so that pitter-patter of fires stopped. And what that meant was that the landscape was allowed to homogenize. It grew up. All those forests that were in different ages of regeneration sort of leveled out, topped out together, and began to fill in and get really dense. And these open areas that had previously been open began to fill in with trees. And so what that did is it took away that mosaic of different habitat types, that patchwork, and it interrupted that negative feedback loop. Because now we've just got this contiguous swath of trees, which is pretty much a contiguous fuel bed ready to go. Those speed bumps are gone. And so that worked well until, you know, right around the year 2000, when it really, no pun intended, backfired. Because now we've got this landscape that's ready to burn, and it's at a point, well, let me back up. The landscape is primed to burn. We've taken out those speed bumps, and we've got climate change. So hotter, drier, windier, longer summers, where it's like this synergistic relationship where we've got these bottom-up effects of the forest all growing in and becoming really primed to burn, and these top-down effects of the climate changing. And so by the year 2000, it's ready to go. It's the perfect environment to start burning. And in 2006, for Lynx is when we really saw the first mega fire that made us go, ooh, okay, yikes. The tripod fire in 2006 burned over 70,000 hectares of what was considered the best lynx habitat in the state. Since then, it's just been ramping up of these mega burns, just year after year, not every year, but many years, we're seeing these huge mega fires. A mega fire being a fire that's over 100,000 acres. To the point where we've got this nearly wall-to-wall situation of mega fires in the North Cascades. And that's what has lynx biologists so worried, because we are in a situation where they've lost what they need to make a living in those recent high-severity burns.
We now know the impact of these mega fires on the forests in the North Cascades. We now need to understand exactly what lynx need in habitat to survive, to ensure their future in Washington for decades to come.
We talked about those big snowshoe feet, and what those allow lynx to do is, in the winter, chase their primary prey, which is snowshoe hares. So another species that's adapted for those deep snow environments. Snowshoe hares use subboreal forest that is also structured in just the right way. And what I mean by that is forest that is tall enough and dense enough that even in the winter, when there's 4 or 5 feet of snow on the ground, they have enough tree poking up out of the snow and at such a density that they have cover from predators. And it's got a thick understory, which they need because they're actually eating the bark and the needles of the spruce and fir trees. So because hares need forest structure that's really dense and has a thick understory, lynx, kind of bang shot, need that too. So this could be mature forest where the branches are reaching down into the snow. This could be regenerating forests that are growing up really just thick as dog hair because they've, in the past 15 or 20 or however many years ago, there was a disturbance. So basically, the snowshoe hares need these thickly structured forests, and so lynx need those as well. So when a fire comes through and burns really hot, that structure is gone. If all that is left is, you know, matchsticks, just blackened tree trunks, snowshoe hares are going to, at least until it regrows, they're not going to be in that area, and so neither are lynx. So that's why we worry about these huge mega fires, because they're burning at a high intensity over large swaths of the landscape and leaving behind, at least temporarily, habitat that's not great. Now, one thing that we have found is that even within these big mega fires, there is still some diversity of burn. There's going to be some fire skips, some lower intensity burn areas. Lynx will make the most of that burn by utilizing some of those fire skips, especially the bigger ones and the ones that are closer to the edge of the burn. And so what that tells us is that we can't just totally dismiss a burned area and say, oh man, that's not habitat. It's going to be, you know, 20 or 30 years until we ever see a lynx in there again. This says to us, okay, this might be a net loss of habitat for lynx. There are elements of that burn that they can make the most of even immediately right after the fire. And that's something to pay attention to, because mega fires are what we're working with. We don't have the option anymore of saying, oh, we'll just use fire suppression and save all that mature forest for lynx. That's not an option anymore. So what we need to do is figure out, okay, if a mega fire impacted landscape is what we're working with, how can we at least a little bit manage these forests for the benefit of lynx? It's a mental shift away from trying to really hold on to the mature forest that we have left and being able to say, all right, we're not going to be able to hold on to that now. That's just our new reality. Let's work with what we've got.
In 2023, Carmen and the Home Range Wildlife Research Team, with the support of the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation, began an intensive field study throughout the Mattau Valley to understand how we might be able to implement forest management techniques that safeguard against lynx habitat loss in the face of growing wildfire risk. This research is hard work. It's in the middle of winter, and the team spend days, weeks, and months tracking, monitoring, and trapping lynx to gain a detailed understanding of the ways they utilize varying degrees of burned habitat in the Mattau Valley.
First of all, our study area is the Tripod burn right now. So that big 2006 megafire that burned most of the best lynx habitat in Washington. And there's sort of two types of fires we can think about. We can think about very recent burns where most of that has been burned severely. Then we know that there may be some residual structures like fire skips, lower severity burn areas that lynx can make the most of, but a lot of that burn is going to be fairly unusable to lynx. Then there's regenerating mega burns, which is the stage that the Tripod fire is in now. It has had 17 seasons since it burned, and about 5 years ago, started to see lynx tracks fairly regularly in that burn when we go out in the wintertime. And that to me said, okay, I think that the trees are starting to grow tall enough that they're providing snowshoe hares with what they need and the lynx are following. And then contrast that to, I guess it was 7 or 8 years ago, when going through that burn looking for lynx tracks, we didn't see any. And so it was like we almost reached this tipping point where it started to be usable again for lynx. And then compare that to now, where after a field season of being out there this winter, we know that there's lynx that are making a living entirely within that burn. And so this said to us, all right, we've got an opportunity to learn how lynx are recolonizing a huge mega burn. It's really this fire transformed landscape. And so we need to get in there and learn, okay, how are lynx using burned areas? All of it. What about them? What specific kinds of habitats within these burns are the best for lynx? Are there certain structures of regenerating forest patches that are better for lynx, or shapes or configurations? Is it still just about the fire skips? Are they primarily targeting fire skips, but they're more comfortable now getting to those fire skips because there are some trees growing up? These are the kinds of questions that we're trying to figure out. So to do that, we've got primarily three different data streams. We are putting GPS collars out on lynx. You know, the way that technology is advanced means that we can get thousands of data points and do really in-depth and detailed habitat selection studies. We can also get accurate home range estimates, and that'll let us know, are lynx that are living within the burn, first of all, how often does that happen? Second of all, is the core of their home range, what are the patches of regenerating burn like in that core? Because if we can figure out, all right, this is the best of the best in a burned area that supports a lynx, then we know, all right, that's really important for trying to enhance or conserve when we're thinking about lynx conservation. So that's the GPS data. The other thing we're doing is a much more low-tech data stream, which is backtracking lynx. And so to do that, we're going out in the winter, riding on snowmobiles. And we're looking for lynx tracks in the snow. And when we find lynx tracks, we follow them. And we call it backtracking because we're going in the opposite direction that the lynx did. And we do that because we don't want to be following the lynx and catching up to it and influencing its behavior. Both just ethically, we don't want to do that. And it could essentially mess up the data because we'd be influencing the lynx. So we backtrack them. And so we're following them. We're using a GPS to record the shape of that track. And we're taking really fine, detailed habitat notes along the way. And so that'll get us two things. The habitat notes will get us a really fine-scaled, detailed characterization of the habitats they're using. The shapes that we're recording, we're wanting to do a movement analysis. And so what we're hoping to learn from that is by analyzing the shape of their movement trail, you can pull apart different behaviors. And here I'm thinking about just traveling. You know, I'm just trying to get from here to there, and I'm just going to go there the quickest way possible. So that would look like more of a straight line versus I'm in a good hunting patch. I'm going to really work it and be looking for snowshoe hares and squiggling around. And so that's that more sinuous trail. And so from that, what we can learn is what is the best hunting habitat? Because again, that right there is the stuff you want to really be promoting and conserving for lynx. Because if they're not able to find snowshoe hares and they're not getting what they need to eat, then there they go. So the third data stream is a camera array. So putting out a bunch of remotely, you know, triggering trail cameras is it's going to allow us to expand our study area. And the reason that that is important is because the tripod burn area is not typical of all of Washington's habitat. Their habitat sort of goes west from this tripod area further up into the mountains, up towards the Cascade Crest. And as it does that, it gets much more rugged and forest types might even be a bit different. And so we want to make sure that when we're learning from the tripod area and extrapolating what we learn to across Lynx Range in Washington, that we're not applying results that don't quite fit these other areas. If the burns are different there and the lynx are using them slightly differently. And the reason we need to use cameras to do this is because a lot of that western part of their range is nearly impossible to access in the winter and is actually designated wilderness. And so trail cameras would be the only way we could get any data out of there. And so the trail cameras are a big part of that is just a function of the logistics of trying to study lynx in an area that's so rugged and remote.
Despite numerous challenges confronting the Canada lynx in this habitat, this research is instrumental in safeguarding a future for the lynx within the Northern Cascades. Even with such a limited population, there are still glimpses of hope that can even catch experienced researchers by surprise.
There was a day this winter when we caught a female lynx and she had a kitten. And when I say kitten, you know, it was a probably 10-month-old kitten. So getting big and getting ready this spring to leave and strike out on its own. But when we caught the female, we processed her, everything went, you know, easily and smoothly. And when we released her, we watched her bound off into this snowy meadow, and it was snowing. It was just a cool day weather-wise. And about a minute later, we saw her kitten come tearing off the hillside to rejoin her. And that was cool to see. Another little reminder that in 2006, when this prime lynx habitat burned, it was a big blow. But now in 2023, here's a female with her kitten making a living on this landscape. I'm Carmen Van Bianchi from Home Range Wildlife Research. If you'd like to learn more about our Lynx and Wildfire project or about Home Range in general, you can go to homerange.org. We've got information on our projects. We've got a donation page. And you can find our social media there to follow as well.
Thank you so much to Carmen for her time, as well as Kristen from Rally for helping arrange this interview. That website again, homerange.org. Catch Cats of the Wild is created by me, Andy Varvel. Theme music is by Score Squad. Other music and sound effects from Envato.